It's March 24th, 2020, and this is Gene Silverman. This is my memoir, which I've entitled So Far. It's for my children, grandchildren, and even future generations if they would like to learn about me, who I am, what I did in my lifetime, and get a better understanding of their family's past. I hope you'll enjoy this memoir as a way to better understand what my life was truly about. I've been blessed with a wonderful life full of interesting adventures, travel to foreign lands, deep spiritual growth, and many beautiful people who I love dearly. But let's start before I was born. My mother's name was Iris Gross. She was born on May 30th, 1928, and she was a very beautiful, dark-haired, brown-eyed woman. Her ever-present smile and sweet demeanor were a welcome invitation to any stranger to start up a conversation about family or events of the day. Her parents, from the Gross and Wax families, immigrated to the United States from the part of Russia now known as Ukraine. My mother's father was named Isidore Gross, or Izzy, I-Z-Z-Y. And the last name was spelled Grush, G-R-U-S-H, on the Ellis Island records. Isidore Gross passed away the summer before I was born in 1951, but my mother would tell me about him always with tears in her eyes. Her mother, my grandmother, was named Rose Gross. Her Yiddish name was Rissel, R-I-S-S-E-L. And their maiden name was Vox, V-O-X, which was anglicized to Wax, W-A-X, when they arrived at Ellis Island in the around 1916. My grandmother Rose was born in 1898 in a small Jewish shtetl called Grussever, something like that, near the city of Odessa. My grandfather, Izzy, was actually a private in the Russian army, but after serving his stint, he came to America and lived in New York City. Izzy found work and sent money back to Russia so that Rissel and her entire family could join him in New York. By my mother's account, her father, Izzy, was a quiet, very gentle soul. And even though he was not even a citizen and barely spoke English, he was drafted into the U.S. Army and served during World War I as a prison guard near the trenches in France. After World War I, Izzy worked in the toy industry, and once in the 1920s, my mother told me he had an opportunity to become a principal in the Ideal Toy Company. However, he didn't have the investment money to buy in. Shortly after that, the Gross and Wax family apparently all moved to Philadelphia. Later in his life, when Izzy became ill with a heart condition, he became very religious, identifying with his Jewish heritage and seeking peace and solace in God during the years before his death. I've also often felt a deep affinity for this grandfather I never met, and even at a young age, I related to his sincere search for God. I think I inherited the soul of a seeker from him. My mother met her husband, your great-grandfather, Irwin Silverman, and Jackson and James and Sadie might remember old Zadie. She met him when she was just 18 and he was 19 at a neighborhood ice cream parlor close to where they lived in the Strawberry Mansion section of Philadelphia. Old Zadie was born on February 7th, 1927. My mother described their meeting to me many times. She and a friend sat at a booth sipping ice cream sodas while Irv, who was a tall, handsome boy in the neighborhood, known as a great baseball player, was sitting with a few of his friends in the next booth. Iris was shy and didn't remember saying anything as the two groups began to flirt, but by the end of the evening, Irv asked her for her phone number. After 2 years of dating, Irv asked Iris to marry him, and they did marry on Thanksgiving Day, November 26, 1949. And 2 years later, I was their anniversary present. arriving November 28, 1951. We know a little less about the Silverman side of our family, although I do know my grandfather, Herman Silverman, who I called Pop-Up, and my grandmother, Sarah Hinken Silverman, who I called Bubby, Bubby Sarah, were the first generation to be born here in the United States. I have their picture in the written format of this. Herman and Sarah lived their entire lives in Philadelphia and were very loving and doting grandparents. Your great-great-grandfather, Pop-Up Herman, took me to my first Eagles game at Franklin Field on my 10th birthday. I remember that the Eagles played against the San Francisco 49ers, and it was so cold that my feet were freezing. One of my earliest memories was when, at the age of four, our family moved from Strawberry Mansion into our new home in the Feltonville neighborhood of Philadelphia. That was at 4895 Whitaker Avenue. My Bubby Rose moved with us, and Aunt Cheryl was born on September 28, 1955, and we lived in the small bedroom, three-bedroom home, which is pictured there in the little booklet. There's pictures of old Zadie when he was a lot younger, and Bubby Iris and Cheryl and me around 1960. A short time after we moved to Whitaker Avenue, my mother brought me two books. One was a book explaining how a baby is born and develops in the womb, and presumably to help me understand how my sister Cheryl arrived. The second book was titled Jeremy Learns About God. I can remember one afternoon in the bedroom I shared with my grandmother Rose, I was looking at the pictures in the God book, and for the first time, I experienced a deep yearning to know and understand God and the meaning and purpose of life. The feeling was very sincere, and on some level, it kind of disturbed the inner innocence of my childhood. But from that moment, even as a child, I became a spiritual seeker, an observer, and a student of life. I experienced a restlessness and a yearning for knowledge. I was simply feeling the natural force of evolution pushing me towards finding truth. Yet there was also a knowingness that there was an answer and someday I would find it. Growing up in America in the 1950s, my favorite TV shows were The Mickey Mouse Club, Howdy Doody, Leave It to Beaver, still can get reruns of that. Father Knows Best, The Rifleman, I watch the reruns every day on MeTV. And they all presented American ideals and values. In 1961, my hero, John F. Kennedy, became president, and all seemed right in the world. Then it was a big contrast to be a teenager in the 1960s. At first, there was fun at summer camp, and I had brief Little League career. But then JFK was assassinated just before my 12th birthday in 1963. The Beatles debuted on American TV on the Ed Sullivan Show in February 1964, and they were to change the culture in many ways. I got a learner's permit and started driving at age 16 and went on dates with girls from other neighborhoods. I played high school basketball on Olney's freshman-sophomore team, and when I was 11th grade, I made the varsity basketball team, but I voluntarily decided to quit so I could play more minutes on the junior varsity team. After a couple of games, I didn't play well, so I was cut from the JV team. Unfortunately, I never got to play in a regular season varsity game, and that was a big disappointment. And I learned a big lesson. Appreciate what you have, and do not go backwards. I did play basketball for 2 years in the Jewish Basketball League for Jewish high school players in Northeast Philadelphia, a league made up of about 10 synagogue teams. I was the third leading scorer 1 year in 1968. I was also a pretty good writer, and in 11th grade, I was sports editor. And as a senior in 1967 to 68, I was managing editor of the Olney Highlights school newspaper. During that time, I also started to identify with the hippie culture and new age thinking of the 1960s. I began to grow my hair long and wore bell-bottom jeans, and that was the style of the time. In the fall of 68, I started my freshman year at Penn State as a 16-year-old because I had skipped two half grades in elementary school. I went to the Penn State campus called the Ogons campus in Abington and majored in psychology because I had it in my mind that somehow I wanted to help people who had mental and emotional health challenges. I spent the summers of 69 and 70 in Atlantic City. In 69, I worked on the boardwalk as a barker for a game arcade. I would have a microphone and call out to people on the boardwalk to come in to play games. There were two Atlantic City lifeguards who would come up and sit under the boardwalk from time to time and ask me to call out on the microphone whenever 20 minutes were up. I didn't realize at the time that they were meditating. They were practicing transcendental meditation. 2 years later at Penn State, Alan Moss, who was one of those lifeguards, would teach me transcendental meditation. That's an interesting coincidence, don't you think? For my junior year in college, I moved to State College and lived with three friends in an apartment at Penn State. Sometime during that October, my world changed dramatically when my apartment roommates and I decided to take a psychedelic drug which was supposed to expand consciousness. I strongly urge you never take drugs, please. The experience that night was frightening. I lost my bearings mentally, and it felt like I lost my sense of self. It was a very difficult few months for me until I learned transcendental meditation on January 29th, 1971. That was the day that changed my life, and it put me on a path to gain the knowledge and experience of the self, which I had been searching for since childhood. After learning TM, I immediately knew that there was something very special and powerful about this technique, which provides deep relaxation, dissolves stress, and expands human consciousness. I could feel my sense of self returning. I felt inner peacefulness during meditation, and I had more clarity of mind. Intuitively, I felt that TM was going to be a very important part of my life going forward. It felt that my higher self was looking at my experience in life and assuring me that everything was going to be all right. In the summer of 1971, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the founder of Transcendental Meditation Movement, was to give a one-month course in July called The Science of Creative Intelligence at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Massachusetts. I wanted to go and see Maharishi, and I wanted to be in his presence and learn more about this powerful technique, which was changing my life. When I told my parents, Bubby and old Zadie, they were very supportive because they thought that meditation was doing good things for me. So I registered to take the SCI course. My plan was to take a bus to Boston and then another bus to Amherst. But the night before I was to leave for the SCI course, my friends and I went out for a midnight snack at Country Club Diner on Cottman in Northeast Philadelphia. This was my favorite restaurant at the time because they made the best cheesecake in the city. On the way home around midnight, we were driving right behind a car with Massachusetts license plates. So I asked my friend who was driving to pull up to that car at the next light. I called over to the driver and asked if he was going to Massachusetts anytime soon. He said yes. He was going back to Massachusetts the next morning. I asked if I could hitch a ride, and he said, sure. I asked where in Massachusetts he was going, and he replied, Amherst. The next day, this gentleman, who turned out to be a professor at UMass Amherst, literally dropped me off right near the registration table for the SCI course. I've always considered that experience to be an amazingly clear example of the support of nature. There would be many, many more instances where the universe seemed to organize things to support me on my path. I have a picture of my ID badge for the SCI course. That was July 1971, when I was 19 years old. The SCI course was wonderful, and each day consisted of three meetings featuring talks by Maharishi. There were about 1,000 course participants there, and I met some very cool people. But it was Maharishi himself who fascinated me. He spoke from firsthand knowledge about the meaning and purpose of life, how TM allowed a person to transcend thought, to go beyond thought, to experience your essential nature and be free of stress and problems in life. He called that state cosmic consciousness, the goal of human life. Maharishi's knowledge was so profound, and I was so grateful for the chance to be in his presence. On the final day of the SCI course, somebody announced that Maharishi would check people's mantras. And although I certainly had no doubt about my mantra, I decided I would wait in line and have him check my mantra just for the chance to be near him. I went to take my place in line and waited for probably an hour to sit next to him for a moment. He checked my mantra, which of course was correct. And then he asked, "You're coming to Mallorca?" And Mallorca was Mallorca, Spain was where the next TM teacher training course was to be held. Without even thinking, I replied, "Yes, Maharishi." The trajectory of my life changed from that one moment. On January 1st, 1972, I boarded a plane for Mallorca, Spain, where I spent 10 weeks in deep meditation and 10 additional weeks doing the same in Fuji Fonti, Italy, learning from Maharishi how to be a TM teacher. On my TM course, there were about 2,000 people. And I remember one evening in Mallorca after Maharishi's talk, Mike Love and Al Jardine sang a few Beach Boys songs with some people playing a guitar and a harmonium. Many nights after the meetings, I used to play cards with Al Bruns. His wife, Prudence Farrow, was the subject of the Beatles song, "Dear Prudence." She would always come over to our card game and urge him to go to bed. When I was about to leave Italy towards the end of May 1972, Maharishi made me a student teacher, meaning that I could only teach people age 26 and younger. I told him that I wanted to be able to teach my parents, and he told me how to do that. He also told me that I should teach 25 people and then find him, he said, wherever I am in the world, because he would then make me a full TM teacher. I quickly taught more than 25 people and found out that Maharishi would be in the U.S. during August of 1972 at a symposium at MIT, a very well-known college in Boston. A friend I was teaching with drove me up to Boston and to attend the conference, which also featured Dr. Hans Selye, the world-renowned author of the book called The Stress of Life, and Buckminster Fuller, the great physics professor. Every evening, as the meeting was winding down, I would run on stage and wait for Maharishi to finish speaking and ask him to make me a full initiator so I would be able to teach TM to people of all ages. The first two nights, he told me he would do it later, but on the third and final evening of the symposium, I waited in the wings for him, and then when he was done speaking, I rushed onto stage and up to his couch. I told him we were leaving the next morning, and so Maharishi told me to come back to the Fenway Hotel with Jerry Jarvis, who was president of the Students International Meditation Society. I rode in the car with Jerry, and he brought me to Maharishi's suite, the top floor of the Fenway Hotel right across the street from Fenway Park, where he and many other people were working on the 33-lesson Science of Creative Intelligence course. Maharishi was on the phone for some time with astronaut Rusty Schweikert, who had recently learned TM. It got very late, and Maharishi asked everyone to go back to their rooms and go to bed, but I persisted. "Maharishi," I called out, "you promised you would make me a full initiator tonight." He smiled and told me to go to his bedroom and do a puja. I did the ceremony of gratitude, and as I was finishing, I noticed out of the corner of my eye, Maharishi came into the room, got into his bed, and he invited me to pull up a chair close to the bed. Then he whispered to me instructions on which mantra to give people older than age 26. With that instruction, I was a full initiator. I thanked him with my hands pressed together and quietly left the suite, wondering how I would find my way back to where I was staying in Brookline at 3 a.m. To my surprise, my friend Kenny Zolo, who had driven me up there, had realized that I was still at the hotel, and he met me in the hallway outside Maharishi's room. He drove me back to get some sleep. Again, wonderful support of nature. In total, I studied with Maharishi for about 2.5 years, from 1971 through 1979. I had the opportunity to speak with him several times and had some insightful moments. He once told me that I should go back home and establish myself in my area. During that period, I started the TM Center in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania, and I personally taught TM to 440 people during that period. I gave many hundreds of TM talks. At one of those lectures in the music room at Northeast High School, I noticed a very pretty girl sitting in the audience. I had seen her before at Penn State, and she had caught my eye then too. She and her younger sister signed up and took the TM course at the TM Center in Jenkintown. These girls were Robin Lazar and her sister Jody. I thought Robin was cute, and after her 4-day course was over, I called her at home and asked her for a date. She told me she had a boyfriend and could not accept the date. Although I was disappointed, things eventually worked out. Robin soon broke up with her boyfriend. She knew he was not right for her, and she wrote me a letter while I was in upstate New York on a TM course for teachers. I wrote back, "The plot thickens." When I came home from that course, Robin and I began to go out together. So that's how Ra-Ra and I started dating, and the rest is history. That's an example of how supportive nature impacted you directly. In 1975, during the time when Robin went to Switzerland to also become a TM teacher, I was diagnosed with testicular seminoma, which was a tumor in my left testicle. I had to have surgery to remove the testicle, and I also had radiation therapy to make sure the cancer would not spread. I was very lucky, and I recovered without any occurrence. When Robin came back from teacher training, I was feeling a little shy about what had happened to me, and we did not continue dating. In fact, Ra-Ra even had a different boyfriend for a while. I really didn't like that Robin was dating someone else, but I felt like I just wanted to be by myself as I recovered from my cancer treatment. Then in 1975, I was attending the 50th wedding anniversary party for Bubby and Pop-Pop, Sarah and Herman Silverman, when I had a clear intuition that Robin should be there with me. It was a realization that Robin was supposed to be part of the Silverman family. That evening, I told my mother what I was feeling. And in her wisdom, she told me that the feeling I had was when you know someone is right for you. I called Robin and asked if I could come over to her house to talk with her. I told her how I felt, and she immediately broke up with her boyfriend that night so we could be together. Robin must have known even then that she was meant to be your Ra-Ra. Robin and I got married on February 27th, 1977, and Justin was born on July 30th, 1980 at Chestnut Hill Hospital. We were starting the family we had always wanted. Zachary was born on December 30th, 1983 at the Booth Maternity Center on the St. Joseph's University campus. I was so happy to have these two beautiful boys. And in 1984, we moved to a larger house at 508 General Patterson Drive in Glenside. Although I was always happiest teaching people TM, I couldn't earn a living really doing that, so I did many different jobs to support our family. At first, when Robin and I got married, I was a substitute teacher in the Philadelphia schools for a year. Then I worked as district director for the American Cancer Society. I spent some time doing public relations work at PATH, which was the community mental health organization in Northeast Philadelphia. I had a job selling salad dressing and soup, and then I even sold work gloves for Robin's Uncle Michael's company. In 1979, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and that has really been some adversity I've had to deal with in this lifetime. After years of many daily insulin injections and pricking my fingers up to 10 times every day to check my blood sugars, I started to wear a blood glucose monitor and insulin pump. You probably remember pushing the button on my belly, which was the glucose monitor transmitter. I am able to constantly check my blood glucose levels by just glancing down at the monitor. Having diabetes has motivated me to try to eat healthy foods and exercise. I do lots of walking and play basketball whenever I can, you know, just shoot around and get my metabolism going. And I think this has kept me relatively healthy. You know that Rara and I never eat meat. In 1980, I took a job selling construction services for Fletcher & Sons, and I worked there until 1985. After that, I helped to start a business called Nature Secrets, which sold vitamins and nutritional products. That lasted for about 1 year, but there is a video that you can see of me selling the Nature Secrets products. Look for Rara, Aunt Cheryl, and a quick shot of your great-great-grandparents in the video. That would be your great-grandparents in the video. My next business venture was a stop smoking program, and along with my future boss, Tim Hawthorne, we created a TV infomercial selling a product called Smoke Breakers in 1986. We had boxes of Smoke Breakers all over our dining room, and that business lasted about a year as well. I hope it helped many people stop smoking, and I know it helped Rara's father, Mott Neal, Neal Lazar, to stop smoking too. In the spring of 1987, Rara and I visited an old friend who offered me a job in Fairfield, Iowa. That was that same Kenny Zolo that had picked me up at Maharishi's room in Boston. And he said they were making lots of money at a company called the International Trading Group. They were selling commodity options. And since we liked the idea of Justin and Zach going to Maharishi School in Fairfield, Rara and I visited Fairfield, and she looked at the house at 604 Hillside Drive. The mailbox already said Silverman on it, so we bought it. Yes, another family named Silverman had been living there, and another playful wink from nature. We moved to Iowa in August 1987. It was difficult to leave our parents and our sisters in Philly. But they came in often to visit, and we came back several times per year for many years. It all worked out beautifully for the 27 years we lived in Iowa. On November 14th, 1991, Rara gave birth to our beautiful Shayna Rose. Shayna was born at the University of Iowa Hospital in Iowa City. Shayna got her name in an amazing way. I had been thinking that because we already had two boys, this baby would also be a boy. But Rara thought differently. She wanted a girl. One night as we were going to sleep, I said, you know, this baby could be a girl. And if it is, I like the name Shayna. Rara jumped out of bed and went to her closet where she found an old yellow notebook. While having a Jyotish reading, which is Vedic astrology, with an old friend named Blaine Watson many years before, Blaine had told Rara that there was a little girl in our future. As she was taking notes, Shayna had written the name Shayna. I'm sorry, Rara had written the name Shayna, S-H-A-N-A, in that notebook. And so it became clear to us that Shayna would be the name of our baby girl. And so it was. I always saw this as another example of the universe making something wonderful abundantly clear in our lives. Our life in Fairfield was wonderful. Zach and Shayna and Justin were great kids, and they were all excellent students. They grew up in a very peaceful and lovely small town, which was the home of the TM movement. They all went to Maharishi School and made names locally for themselves playing baseball and basketball. I coached them all in Little League over a period of about 18 years, and I'm so proud of each and every one of our children for being such loving, kind, and smart people. In 1989, I started to work at Hawthorne Communications in Fairfield. The agency would later be known as Hawthorne Direct and eventually Hawthorne Advertising, and is now based in Los Angeles. I started as a salesman, but soon became president of the advertising agency. I became known as an expert in direct response marketing and producing TV commercials. And our agency had some very well-known and respected clients like Time Life, Hoover, Dyson, Black & Decker, Dexcom, the company that makes my continuous glucose monitor, Home Advisor, and many more big brands. In 1998, I left Hawthorne for 6 years and was a consultant for Time Life and QVC. I went back to Hawthorne in 2004 as vice president of marketing. At Shayna's senior prom at Maharishi School, Rara and I were chaperones. The famous meditator and singer-songwriter Donovan Leitch was visiting Fairfield that weekend and stepped up to the microphone and played his song Atlantis, because the theme of the prom was Under the Sea. Justin and Zach moved back to Philadelphia after their college days and met their future wives, Jennifer and Nicolette. In 2014, Rara and I decided to move back to Philadelphia as well so we could be near our beautiful grandson, Jackson, who was born October 17th, 2013. We were blessed again and again and again and again when James was born April 10th, 2016. Sadie was born on January 17th, 2017. Gavin was born on September 21st, 2018. And Jonah was born on January 28th, 2020. We bought a house at 500 Harrison Avenue in Glenside. And Justin and Jen moved to our old street, General Patterson Drive in Glenside. Zach and Nicolette also moved very close by in Wincote. We are so lucky to live so close to each other. And although Aunt Shayna moved to Washington, D.C. to teach at the very prestigious Sidwell Friends School, she comes home very often. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit the U.S. in March 2020, Shayna came to stay at Zach and Nicolette's suite, so we are all living close by at this time. We're trying to support each other physically and emotionally as best we can. And although we're staying distant from each other, Rara and I are making an effort to see our children and grandchildren often to make the situation bearable. I don't know how this terrible virus will affect our family, and I hope that we all get through this safe and healthy. But I do know that we love each other and are trying to get through this challenging time by loving and caring for each other. I pray that God will shine his blessings on all of us, as well as the entire world. In this lifetime, you have been blessed to be born into a great family. The Silverman family is healthy, happy, and financially stable, and we have very cute, smart grandchildren. We all love one another, and the family is the greatest achievement of my lifetime. In addition to our beautiful family, it's also been my honor to speak with many thousands of people about transcendental meditation and personally teach over 1,200 people to meditate. I feel that meditating for almost 50 years so far and teaching TM has been very fulfilling. Nature has supported me in so many ways. As you reach the age of five, my plan is to teach you a walking word of wisdom. And at 10 years old, I will teach you your sitting TM technique. I love you all so much, and I truly hope that your life will be happy, healthy, fun, beautiful, loving, and enlightening experience. I hope you always know deep inside just how special you are to me and to your Rara. So Jackson, James, Sadie, Gavin, and Jonah, and future grandchildren and great-grandchildren I may not ever know, be proud of your family heritage and enjoy your life. Life is a great gift and a beautiful ride. Meditate every day. Be kind, be loving to all, and always do what you know to be right. Let your inner light shine for the entire world to see. I love you. To infinity and beyond.